Good morning. If you're wondering why it's me up here and not Diane, she's sick, and so I kind of hustled and put my lesson together. So we're not actually doing Numbers 1 through 12. We're doing my lesson, which was next week. So we're doing Numbers 13 through 20. So I know most of you probably didn't know that and didn't read it. But doesn't matter. We'll just read it as we go along. So next week it'll be Diane, and then it'll be back to normal. So I'm later going to tell you a little bit about this article I read, but this was in 1989, but this is a picture on the article of Einstein playing the violin, Lorraine. So as she was playing, and a lot of you missed it, I was staring down at Einstein playing. It was beautiful, thanks. So I don't have a lot of background, but here's a little bit about Numbers. Numbers is the fourth book of the Pentateuch, the Torah or Law of Moses, and we've been now through the first three, and in a few weeks we'll start Deuteronomy. Isn't it amazing that we can move through these at kind of a leisurely pace? I hope you're enjoying it instead of shooting through in 1 week doing, you know. The English word numbers comes from when the Israelites numbered their eligible males for military service twice, once in Numbers 1 and once in Numbers 26. But the Hebrew name in the Hebrew Old Testament is after the words in the wilderness or in the desert, and that's in the first verse of Numbers. So Numbers covers nearly 39 years that Israel spent right after leaving their camp at the foot of Mount Sinai and before they go into the land of Canaan, the promised land, and which starts when they start their preparations to enter in chapter 20. So we are doing these chapters where they begin their wandering in the wilderness, and we'll learn about that. So these events are not always happy events, and in fact, they are a lot of tragedy and hardship. So go with me to 10 and 12 of Numbers. This is where it begins, kind of. So chapter 10, verse 12. And the children of Israel took their journeys out of the wilderness of Sinai, and the cloud rested in the wilderness of Paran. So they begin. And then if you look back at 9:17, you learn how they traveled. And when the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, then after that, the children of Israel journeyed, and in the place where the cloud abode, there the children of Israel pitched their tents. So we know from this that they didn't move daily, every day, or even weekly, but often were in one spot for an extended period of time. And we also think that they were actually in one spot maybe for years, being shepherds, but not able to enter into Canaan and settle down. So let's start Numbers 13. And what is happening is they are on the edge of the promised land, the edge of Canaan. They're about to go in. So Moses, I mean, this is before everything goes to pieces, right? So Moses sends out 12 spies up into Canaan to see what the land is like and the military capabilities of its people and all that. So chapter 13, verse 17, and Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan. Get you up this way southward and go into the mountain. So they had to go around, but then up north. And if you look on a map, in fact, let's look on the map. Go on the back to map 3 of your Bibles. And it says on it, the Exodus. So if you look down, you can see the peninsula of Sinai right here, the V. And that's where they have been at the bottom of Mount Sinai camped. So as the red line moves up, you can see the wilderness of Paran in the middle. And then there's this kind of red circle. And that's kind of where they stay for 40 years in that little circle. But when Moses sends out these 12 spies, they go all the way up to the edge of Syria, in fact, into, which is way above the map, to Hamath, I think, Hamath. And so, which is about 180 miles. So they're going up, they're probably hiding, they're running, they're, you know, anyway. So, look at Numbers 18 and 20. This is where he instructs them. Look at the land, see what it is, 13 and 18. Well, there's a river, sorry. 13 and 18. Look at the land, what it is, the people that dwelleth therein, whether they be strong or weak or many, whether the land is good or bad, whether the cities, what they're like, if they're strongholds, you know, if they have walls, whatever, and if the land is fat or lean, and bring back some fruit. And so we know what the land can bear. So they do, and they come back with this huge cluster of grapes in verse 23. So then what happens? Then the men begin to report, and you know about this, verse 27. They say to the whole group, right, all the Israelites, well, the land flows with milk and honey, but, verse 28, the people that dwell in the land and the cities are walled are really great and big. And we saw the children of Anak there. And then look over in verse 33. We saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which came of the giants. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight. So Anak means neck. So these people were sons of Nek, or tall people. And the whole history of these giants, I care. This is my daughter, Kara, and her three children. I'm so glad you came. Okay, back to the giants. Once I did a study of these giants because I was so interested in them. And the whole history of them in the Old Testament is kind of murky. The Hebrew word for this word is Nephilim, which in other places like Genesis 6 and 4 is implied to be angels coming down and mating with the daughters of men. But whatever they were, which we don't really know because it is murky, they were a frightening and a scary people. So there are two spies, however. There's Caleb and there's Joshua, who bring a different report. So look at verse 30. This is Caleb. He stilled the people. He says, wait, he says, we can go up. Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. Now, Caleb is from the house of Judah, the tribe, and Joshua is an Ephraimite, which we learn earlier on. But the men, this is verse 31, said, we be not able to go up against these people. They're stronger than us, and they bring an evil report of the land. So we just read this. You can see they say that we were, so when they say we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, you can see what the effect was in their own minds, right, of themselves. We're just grasshoppers, we're nothing. And you can see how they project their own feelings about themselves into the minds of these giants, and we were in their sight. They don't know what they thought. What's happening in their heads? Doesn't it take a lot of psychoanalysis to see that this attitude had a crippling, almost paralyzing effect on them, right? And they begin to influence the whole congregation. And they, verse 14, verse 1, weep all night. You know, they're saying, what are we going to do? You know, and they're terrified. Verse 2 of 14, their fear leads them into this rebellion against Moses' leadership again. And they say, would God that we had died in Egypt or in the wilderness, you know, violin starts playing. Sorry, I don't mean to make fun of them, but honestly, over and over again, our wives and our children will be prey. And then they say, let's make a new captain and go back. Wow. So Joshua and Caleb are distraught. They tear their clothes, verse 6. They're trying to convince the people. And they spake unto all the company. This is verse 7. It's a good land, they say. If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land, a land with which floweth with milk and honey. Rebel not against the Lord. Don't be afraid of the people. They are bread for us. Well, isn't that an interesting comment? We're going to eat them alive, you know, probably where it comes from. And then this beautiful phrase, their defense is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. They're trying their hardest. But it only brings them, verse 10, death threats of stoning. So Moses and Aaron, Joshua and Caleb are all pretty traumatized by what's happening. It's an affront to Jehovah. Moses and Aaron are prostrate on their faces. An alternative translation for their defense in verse 9 is departed from them is their shadow has departed from them. Just love that. As in the shadow that gives protection from rocks in a hot country. So literally, we learn in Deuteronomy 32 and 4 where it says, he is the rock. Jehovah is the rock. It is saying their shadow has left them. Jehovah has left them, but he's with us. Stop being so negative. So how to account for the difference in what these two groups of people saw? How do you account for that? Is it just attitude? You know, you hear that a lot. The glass is empty or full, right? Half full. Is it just attitude? How do you account for what their report is? Well, look, we get a hint in verse 24 of chapter 14. But my servant Caleb, because he had another spirit with him and hath followed me fully, and then it goes on. So what was the spirit that Caleb had in him that enabled him to be positive? Well, he had the Spirit of God, which, as you know, is an enabling spirit. It's a spirit of movement and hope and faith. They weren't blind. They saw the people in the land who were civilized people. They'd been under the Babylonians for years, then the Egyptians. They're not hill country people, but they were warlike people. But Joshua and Caleb believed. They believed what God had told them. They believed in his power. There's no other way of explaining it. You know, it's hard to believe like that when things get tough, right? I'm not here to say that it's easy, but sisters, do we trust God or not? Are we with him or are we not? I think it's a matter of choice. It's always, isn't it, a matter of choice. So Scott Peck, the author and psychiatrist, and wrote in this novel, In Heaven as on Earth, that I read years ago, that what causes burnout in psychotherapists is not the tragedy in their patients' lives, but the patient's attachment to their tragedy. So in other words, we find that staying with a status quo is a lot easier than moving forward with hope and faith. It's hard to look fear in the face. And healing. So years ago when we were in Puerto Rico on our mission and Annie was with us, our daughter who is 10, was 10, and she had a pet and it was a bird. Because you can't have pets, right? So we had this patio, and I had put the bird in his cage out on the patio. And she came running in, so I brought Eddie. This is Eddie. he's really kind of a mean bird, but he was really happy to get out. So anyway, so she comes running in and she says, "Mom, listen." And we could hear the bird just going crazy in his cage, flapping its wings and hitting the cage and rattling. And so we go running out, and there is a cat up on the table right by the bird, looking into the bird. And of course, the bird's, you know, trying to escape. Well, aren't we like that sometimes? So caged in and frantically trying to get back to Egypt and not seeing the big picture. So there are quite a few of these revealing passages that show in Numbers and in the Pentateuch the contrast between Egypt and a place of bondage for them, but security on one hand, and the wilderness, a place on the way to freedom and opportunity, but filled with insecurity and problems. And it points it out over and over again. So, onward, verse 11, 14, Jehovah gets angry and says, "How long do I have to put up with this?" Now, I won't take time, but if you read there's an incident in the book of Mark where Jesus comes down from the mountain and the scribes are surrounding his apostles, and he says, "What's going on here?" And it's the time when the man says about his boy, "Help thou mine unbelief." You know that story. And Jesus, when he hears that his apostles have tried to heal the boy, says, "How long shall I have to wait for you?" So here's the same being saying the same words. Isn't that interesting? How long? And an alternate, the New English translation says, "How much longer will this people treat me with contempt and refuse to trust me?" And so Jehovah wants to just destroy them all and raise up a new seed from Moses. But Moses intervenes and prevents it. And you get these beautiful verses, verse 18, where Moses said, "You're not like that, God. You're long-suffering, you're merciful, you're kind." And so verse 19 and 20, God pardons them, but he says there is a consequence. And what is it? That they can't go into Canaan. So if you look at verse 23, "They shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers." And if you go over the page at 29, he's pretty blunt. "Your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, all of you that are 20 years old and upward." So all the adults will die in the wilderness because of this incident, except for verse 24, except for Caleb, who had another spirit in him, and also Joshua. So just quickly, Joshua 14, if you want to just flip over there really fast, is the end of this story. You know how, was it, who was it on the radio said the end of the story? I can't remember anyway, never mind. So look at Joshua 14 verse 7, and I won't read the whole thing, but this is Joshua talking. And or is it Caleb? It's Caleb. And he says, "I was 40 years old when I was sent by Moses. The brethren that were with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed God, and you know, he goes on, and now he says, I want my land that you promised. And he gets it. He's now 85. So that's the end of this incident. Anyway, so they get what they have asked for, what they have wanted. They don't get to enter Canaan, and they have to change their direction from north to south. And there's a tragic ending in verse 39 of 14. The people miss the whole point of what's happened, and they are all of a sudden repentant and saying, we're going anyway, we're going, you know, we're fine now, and they all run up into Canaan, or they start, and the tribes just come down and just crush them and kill them, the ones that went. Because Moses said, I'm not coming, and I'm not bringing the ark, and God told you, you can't go. But they went anyway. So that's the ending. So if you go to Hebrews 3, and I'll just read this, 17 through 19, and this often happens where you will read in later Bible passages comments about what has happened. But with whom was he grieved 40 years? Was it not with them that had sinned, whose carcasses fell in the wilderness? And to whom swear he that they should not enter into his rest, but to them that believed not? So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. So I've spent a lot of time on this incident because it was of great significance to Israel. It wasn't just a matter of attitude, was it? It just wasn't. I mean, it's wonderful to have a good attitude, but the main thing is that they chose to not believe. They chose to let their fear stop them. So chapter 15 gives them these sacrifices, a way they can repent. And I just wanted to stop on this one little phrase, and we've talked about it a couple times, but and it's in verse 3 of chapter 15. And he's talking about, you know, making your feasts to make a sweet savor unto the Lord. And this phrase, a sweet savor, is repeated over and over again. To make a place in your worship that has four beautiful smells. Isn't that interesting? A place in your worship for beautiful smells. It was believed that God himself smelled them. So look at Genesis 8 and 29. This little verse, but you can see what I mean. I'll just read it. He says, let's see, 8 and 21, and the Lord smelled a sweet savor. So this is where it comes from. They thought he was smelling their sacrifices. But then listen to this. Paul in Ephesians 5 and 2 says that Christ, out of love for us, hath, and here's the scripture, hath given himself for us an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet smelling savor. So he was what was sweet smelling himself. And then Paul in Ephesians or Philippians says, and here's the background. He's out there. We studied Paul. He's alone. He's, you know, cranky, hard to be around. And he gets these packages from people that are out there that are trying to help him. And he says in Philippians 4 and 18, I am full, he says, having received the things which were sent from you, an odor of a sweet smell, a sacrifice acceptable, well-pleasing to God. So to him, the odor of the sweet-smelling things was loving God and loving each other, which I thought was really sweet as things went on in the world. Okay, the next big thing that happens is in chapter 16, and I'm just going to kind of quickly go over it because I have other things that I'd rather, you know, talk about. But there's this direct challenge against Moses, against his civil authority and his ecclesiastical leadership. And Korah, this man Korah, says these really sad words. Look at verse 3. Ye take too much upon you. He's speaking to Moses. Seeing all the congregation are holy, not just you, every one of them. These are pretty harsh words. Wherefore then lift yourself up. Wow. And he's got 250 men behind him and practically the entire congregation. So they are not happy with the status quo. And then if you look over on 12, he asks these other two men that are in on the rebellion, Dathan and Abiram, to come and meet with him. In verse 12, we will not come. Is it a small thing that thou hast brought us out of a land that floweth with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness? And you are making yourself a prince over us? Wow. Moreover, thou hast not brought us into the land of milk and honey. You said you would, and yet why haven't they? Because they have been so unbelieving. And Moses, look at verse 15. We talked about Moses' personality, how he had anger in him, or at least was capable of a temper. Moses was very wroth and said, I haven't taken one ass from them, neither have I hurt one of them to God. So he's, you know, pushing back. So what happens is there's a showdown, fire comes down, earthquake, and they're all killed, all the rebels, and a plague. And then Moses, a plague comes at the end, and Moses sends Aaron running out with a censer of incense, and he stands between the plague and the non-plague people and stops it. It's quite dramatic. But what a revelation of human nature, isn't it? That we all think, I'm just as holy as he is. Why should he have that office? Or even in your work, I'm just as smart as him. Why did he get that promotion? Or why does she, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So that's us, right, as humans. So one thing that happens in a connection with this rebellion is in the next chapter, 17, and it's quite beautiful. This is the one about Aaron's rod. And Aaron, or Moses, tells them, he's been told by God, have every man from each tribe bring a rod and put it in the tabernacle, and whosoever rod blooms the next morning is the one that should be the high priest, because they have been agitating, right? And so that's what happens. They bring their rods. Here's my rod. And the next morning, look at verse 8. And it came to pass that on the morrow Moses went into the tabernacle, and behold, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi was budded and brought forth buds and bloomed blossoms and yielded almonds. So it didn't only just blossom, but it had buds on it and blossoms and almonds all at the same time. So a rod was the mark of a person of distinction. So each tribal leader would have had their rod, and that led to, of course, like princes having a scepter, right? Because it's like the rod. So it was the sign of a ruler. So Aaron had been consecrated with oil. His wasn't just a natural preeminence, you know, he wasn't just smart. He had been consecrated to be the high priest. So that is what God is saying by having Aaron's rod blossom, and then he has Moses put the rod in the ark to stay there forever. So it stays in the ark with the tablets of the law and the pot of manna that's in there. So the almond tree, there's all kinds of symbolism that is connected to this event and to the almond tree. The almond tree is all throughout the scriptures. It originated in the Middle East, and as I said, mentioned over and over again, the almond tree blossoms the earliest of all trees. So like 6 months ahead of when it fruits in the fall. Almond means awake. It's become a symbol of Jehovah's wakefulness or watchfulness. So Jehovah is watching over Israel, and also a symbol of promise. And it's also a symbol of vision. So Jeremiah 1 and 11 is asked, Jeremiah, what do you see? And he says, and I said, I see a rod of an almond tree. So this is the first of Jeremiah's visions. It's also a symbol of resurrection and of new life. But it's also a symbol of death. What happens if you were to eat a bitter almond? Does anyone know? You would die if you ate, because it has cyanide in it. It's in the same family as like apricot pits that you're not supposed to eat. So it's actually, so I'm looking this up on Google, you know. It's actually in a lot of seeds, but cyanide is, it's a natural element. But isn't this interesting that it is both life and death? As we've talked about over and over again on all these symbols, and as in a couple weeks when we talk about the snake on the post that Moses holds up is also life and death. So the bitter almonds are round, so those are okay. Just so you know, though, don't eat them. Okay, what does it mean to flow with milk and honey? What does that mean? Have you ever stopped on that little phrase? So I brought my milk and my honey just as a, you know, visual aid. But so the spies come back, we just read, and it says, and they said that Canaan flows with milk and honey. We just read, 14 and 8, where Caleb says, if the Lord delight in us, he will bring us into this land, which floweth with milk and honey. As early as Exodus 3 and 8, Moses is told that the Lord will bring them into a land flowing with milk and honey. So the phrase suggests that it's a land able to sustain herds, right? Because the milk mostly came from goats, and the goats needed pasture. So it's a land that has pasture, that is, you know, fertile. And the honey, maybe the bee honey, but most likely it was a date. You know, there are many kinds of dates, and there is a thick, sweet date that is like honey. And I brought my dates. I love dates. And when I was in Pasadena once with my daughter, in the street markets, they have lots of dates because they grow them there, you know, like 8 kinds of dates. And because I liked them, I bought one of each thing and tried them all. It was really fun. But anyway, even though Canaan was hilly and rocky, it was also very productive. Different from the Nile region, but still could grow wheat and barley and grapes and figs and pomegranates and olives and almonds and nuts and onions and garlic and leeks and melons and spices. So a lot. So it was a land of milk and honey, a land of great fertility. Now here's an interesting thing. If you look in 16, this rebellion I just told you about, and we read verse 13, the rebel leaders used the phrase, which is a divine phrase used by God as a description of the promised land, and they use it to describe Egypt, a land of bondage. Wow. Is it a small thing that thou hast brought us out up out of a land that floweth with milk and honey? So they use it. And then they complain in the same breath, moreover, you haven't brought us into the land of milk and honey, you know. So here's my question. And I don't want to be obvious, but it's pretty obvious. Where is your land of milk and honey? Is it a place in your past that you wish you could only go back to? Is it in the future where everything will be better? Is it now with your wild, messy children in your wild, messy house? Is it in your quiet, empty house? Where is your land of milk and honey? When we were in Puerto Rico, we would occasionally attend the Metro Ward, which was the English-speaking ward. Hardly ever, I have to say. And I heard a really sad talk. There was a family moving. They had lived there for 6 years. I think they were FBI. There's a ton of FBI English-speaking people. And the mom was speaking, and she said she was not sorry to go. She couldn't stand one more tapón, which is a traffic jam, or going in one more store. She'd made no effort to learn Spanish. She spent most of her time, as much as possible, on the base, Fort Buchanan. I liked her. She was a good mom. She taught seminary to the kids. Where was her land of milk and honey for 6 years? So this article I wanted to tell you about that I may have a couple of years ago brought up. This was an article by a woman named Judith Groach. And she's talking about her father who had just died at 85. He was a professor of medicine. He made house calls until the last days of his life. He was elegant, autocratic, old fashioned in the best sense of the word. And when he was old, as when he was young, he was intent on the open-ended business of living. In the ambulance after his heart attack, he said, "Slow down, young man, or I shall get out." So, but this is what I want you to know about him. He continued to learn years after his leg muscles failed and his heart sounded strange to his own stethoscope. He was a master of languages, German, French, Hebrew, Latin. He studied Arabic at 70, ancient Greek at 75, so he could read original texts. And somewhere in the middle of all this, he learned to read musical notation so he could explore the Beethoven piano sonatas. There's my Beethoven. His music teacher would come to his office while his poor patients waited, and out in the waiting room, and they would pore over the scores. He studied poetry, philosophy, rare books. As a young man, though pressed by the needs of family and patients, he began the long struggle against the contraction of time and space that too often marks the frenzied, joyless life of adult purpose. His lifelong style by inclination and talent was to nurture his mind, because the mind has a life beyond work. He needed what Einstein called the deep shudder of the soul in enchantment. He needed music studies in the middle of the day. So listen to this promise. In fact, why don't you look it up in Deuteronomy 6 and 3. This is right before the Shema, the two great commandments. So it's not actually the commandment, but it's right before. You ready? "Hear, therefore, O Israel, and observe to do it, that it may be well with thee, and that ye may increase mightily, as the Lord God of thy fathers hath promised thee, in the land that floweth with milk and honey." Isn't that a beautiful connection that I found? I just loved it. You will increase in the land of milk and honey. Okay. There's a couple more things I want to talk about. In chapter 18, it's a lot about the priests, but look at starting about verse 20. He starts talking about tithes. The Levites would receive tithes. Well, the Levites had no land, right? They had no inheritance. They were to have no inheritance in Canaan. Their inheritance was to be the tithes from the people. So they were paying tithing back then. That's in verse 20. "Thou shalt have no inheritance in the land, neither shalt thou have any part among them. I am thy part and thine inheritance, I God, I Jehovah. And behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tenth in Israel for an inheritance." So, but here's the interesting thing. Look at verse 26. The Levites who get the tithes from the people, "Then ye shall offer up a heave offering of it, even a tenth part of the tithe." So the Levites are to tithe their tithes that they receive. So what does that tell you? And it's not only that. Look over on 29. It's got to be the best part thereof of what you got, it was probably mostly in kind, right? So I know money is a touchy topic. I know that Diet Coke is a touchy topic. Is my sister here, Susan? She's very touchy about Diet Coke. I brought that just for her. And she's not even here. And my money. But, so I know it's, in fact, here's this little quote. Truly a man and his money are past understanding. Which I thought was very clear. It must not have always been paid, because remember in Malachi where it says, will a man rob God, but ye have robbed me in tithes and offerings? So obviously they had not been really good. But a tithe of a tithe, I could go on about this. In fact, I went on with one of my kids and she's finally going, stop. I mean, a tithe is less than we give a waitress, isn't it? Or a waiter. Do we love God less? I hesitated whether to talk about this, but I'm just going to say a little bit more. Do we tithe because it's money and say, well, that money has been tithed? Or is the tithe for something else for us? So like my dad worked for the church forever, and he was a general authority. So he got money as a living allowance, and people would say, you get money for being a general authority? And we would go, well, is it okay if we eat, you know, and live in a house? I mean, I'm sorry, but to us it was pretty obvious that it had to come from somewhere. So that's all tithing money. Was he to tithe on his tithing money? Do you see? Well, of course, because we pay tithing on our increase, and he paid more. He always paid more. So that's probably enough on that touchy topic. Chapter 20 is the end of their stay in the wilderness. They start to get ready to move in, and it's kind of a sad chapter. They're back at Kadesh, where they started. And most of those years, those 38, 9 years, are a blank. We don't have a record of them. And there is a reference to the Book of the Wars of the Lord in Numbers, which maybe has it. So 20, verse 1, Miriam dies, is reported, and later Aaron's death is also reported. So that's kind of the end of Jehovah's decree that all the adult Israelites would die. And then, of course, Moses. But before Aaron's death, the lack of water again turns Israel against Moses. And we don't have a lot of time, but look at verses 2. There was no water. The people, verse 3, chode with Moses. Oh, that we had died when our brethren died in the wilderness, probably back to 16. Verse 5, there's no place here that has seeds or figs or vines or pomegranates, and there's no water to drink. And their animals had no water. So they're blaming Moses, in effect, for their own faithlessness. So the Lord instructs Moses, verse 8, he says, take a rod, speak ye unto the rock in there, in front of them, and water will come out. So Moses did that, or he goes up. And then he says, look at verse 10, Moses and Aaron gather everybody, must we fetch you water out of this rock? And he lifted up his hand, and with his rod, he smote the rock twice, and the water came out abundantly, and everybody drank. So you know that a bad thing's about to happen, right? Because you know the story. Everything goes wrong. The Lord is angry. Verse 12. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron, because ye believed me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given you. This is the water of Meribah. So for centuries, people have tried to wrap their minds around what Moses did that was so bad that this one mistake would cancel out years of faith and obedience and devotion. We know in the book of Moses, he is in the similitude of the only begotten. We know he came back at the Mount of Transfiguration with Elijah to Peter, James, and John. We know he came to the Kirtland Temple to Joseph and Oliver Cowdery. So it's not like he was erased, you know. Dr. Schofield, who has written a beautiful reference book, or reference Bible, wrote this little list of the gravity of Moses' offense. So I'm just going to use what he said. This is part of what he said. He took credit to himself. So look at verse 10, back of chapter 20. Must we fetch you water? He disobeyed God in not speaking to the rock. Remember God, verse 11 says, speak to the rock, and Moses hit it with his rod. He was provoked about their need and resented them. That same phrase, must we do this? I don't know, failed to glorify God before his people, rebelled against God. So I don't know. I don't think, you know, we have the whole record. I mean, this is Moses. We love Moses. This is Moses. So I'll just leave it there. Israel's about to go up into to Canaan once again after all these years, and they send word to Edom. Edom, who is Edom? You remember? Edom is the people of Edom are the descendants of Esau. These are their brothers. And they say, no way. And they come out with all their force and say, no way, you're walking through our land. And we don't have time, but in Amos 1 and 11, in fact, the whole book of Obadiah is about the anger of Edom that still lasts. And then in Amos it says, Edom, his anger did tear perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever. Speaking of holding on to anger. But anyway, so they have to go around and then up. Aaron dies. We don't know exactly where. It's Mount Hor, but no one knows exactly. They think it's at in the area of Petra. And so there's a little mosque on this mountain near Petra. Look at 20 and 25 and 26. Aaron and Moses and Eleazar, Aaron's son, who his oldest son, who will now be the next high priest, go up the mountain. And Moses takes the priestly robes that we have learned about in Exodus off of Aaron and puts them on Eleazar. And it's like a transfer of office. But it's even more because, you know, clothes in those days were thought to be part of the personality of a person. So it's like passing on Aaron's holy characteristics. So wouldn't it be interesting if when you borrowed your daughter's clothes, you became your daughter? I'd take that care. So Aaron dies, verse 28, there on top of the mount, and the people mourn. Listen to this lovely quote, and I'll end, sorry. To meet death as Aaron met it, to make a good death, is surely the test of a good life. It is to die on top of the mountain in sight of the promised land. I thought that was really nice. So sometimes text or material seems to circle around one theme or one thought, and these chapters for me seemed to be asking over and over again, what do we bring to life? How do we see the events of our lives? So if you read Psalm 78, it's a lot about these chapters, but I'll just end with these two verses. How oft did they provoke him in the wilderness and grieve him in the desert? Yea, they turned back and tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel. So let us not limit his power, the Holy One of Israel, to help us, to save us, to heal us, to bring us into a land of milk and honey, into the promised land, where I believe we are lucky to be every day. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.